From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you have a loved one hospitalized with COVID-19, you probably can't be with them. Hospitals are keeping relatives out to minimize spread of the virus.
We've been relegated to the place to make sure that we are creating models of care where we are serving public health more than we're serving individual health at this point, because we have to.
Today, what it means to be an advocate when you can't even get next to the bedside. Also, maintaining mental health at home. It'd be challenging even for those with no anxiety, but there are things you can do to keep despair at bay.
We can be physically distant and safe, but not be asocial. The idea of socially distancing from other people, not being connected to others, is scary to us. We are social creatures.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Stay with us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, some straight talk about preserving your mental health as you're at home.
One of the things that I've been trying to talk with parents about is taking some time to manage your own responses to the pandemic, and that can be things like taking a walk outside while we still can do that, just taking a moment for yourself to kind of de-stress and give yourself a break.
But first, some thoughts on what this time is like if you're at home and thinking of someone far away hospitalized with COVID. If someone you love has coronavirus, things get bad, you may take them to the ER, and then you're told to leave. You might not get any news about how they're doing for days. Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett brings us this story of some families on the outside and what they're doing to advocate for their loved ones.
Monique Baker McCormick had a hard time getting her dad to agree to go to the hospital. He could barely stand, she says, but he would not get in her car or even open the door to his house to let her in. McCormick, who is a Wayne County commissioner, took him to DMC's receiving hospital in Detroit, the ER.
And basically, once I got in the back, they told me I couldn't be there and that I had to leave. And it's scary. It's scary for him, and I could see it in his eyes.
That was day one. Day two, she didn't hear anything. That was her dad's birthday. He turned 74. She says those 2 days were the hardest, the not knowing. Day three, she tracked someone down who told her dad was stable, but his room didn't have a phone, so she couldn't talk to him. She kept calling her dad's doctor, not getting an answer. She's watching the news. It's all death and dying. Finally, on day four, she got to hear his voice. And on day five, she got a hold of his doctor. He sent her a picture of her dad.
Oh, it was just like, just a wonderful feeling just to see his face and be able to, even though he was in the hospital, in a hospital bed, it was still just being able to see him and know that he's still with us.
McCormick got some even better news over the weekend. Her dad was doing so well, he got to come home. Now, not everyone can snag a doctor's cell phone number. Mary Kay Hill's sister was admitted to Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak on March 24th. Tested positive for COVID. Their family's close. Two brothers, Mary Kay and her sister.
No matter who's in the hospital, one of us will always be there. And so that's why it's very difficult for us to not be in a position where we can advocate, especially because my sister is not like me in the way that she understands medical terminology, and she understands kind of like, she doesn't really know what to look for and what to ask for when it comes to medical stuff.
Hill says her mom called the hospital to try and get information. No one called back. Hill says she understands. They're overwhelmed, doing their best. Hill's sister brought a cell phone with her into the hospital, though, so Hill could text her sister questions to ask the doctor, like, what's your pulse oximeter reading today? And asked her sister to relay the answers back to her. But there were long, terrifying stretches where her texts just went unanswered.
And our stomachs are in knots, and we have, like, the pit, you know, the dread pit kind of residing within us.
Hill says she just never imagined being in this situation, not being able to be by her sister's side, not being able to see what's happening, knowing how quickly things can go south. Hill's sister was not put on a ventilator. She came home this weekend. But in that same hospital, Biba Adams has not one, but two family members, both on ventilators, her mother and her grandmother. They live together. On March 26th, they both went into the hospital with COVID infections. unbelievably, on that very same day, the virus killed Adam's aunt. Biba Adams says when all this hit, they were in the middle of planning her grandmother's 90th birthday party.
For this upcoming December, like, looking at caterers and, like, all this, you know, all this stuff. And I think that the thought of losing so much of my family history at one time, that started hitting me today.
Adams says the care her mom and grandmother are getting is extraordinary. And she has this advice for anyone stuck at home with a loved one in the hospital.
I think the smartest thing to do is have, like, one person calling. So my aunt calls every morning, and then I call maybe in the evening. And that's it. Like, nobody else. It shouldn't be, like, a whole bunch of people calling up there. You know, like, I think it's the time to develop that type of plan. If you have a loved one in the hospital, just let it be one person who calls. Let them know that person by name. You know, that I think that's helping our family.
Adams says she asked one of the Beaumont nurses the other day, is there anything I can do for you? Do you need anything? Food? No, the nurse told her. We're up to our necks in pizza. Just stay home and wash your hands. For Stateside, I'm Sarah Hewlett.
Increasingly, hospitals are designating staff time toward improving people's experiences with inpatient stays. For issues like communication and a wealth of other things, Kelly Parent is Vice President of Family Experience for Beaumont Health, and she joins us now via phone. Kelly, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
We know that last week was a brutal one at Beaumont. How would you say the team is holding up?
I am incredibly inspired by the team at Beaumont. Honestly, with all of the fear that is out there, if you talk with any team member at Beaumont, they bring courage to you. They are something else. Despite the fear, despite the isolation, despite the death, they are going to work every day and putting their all in so that they can save all of us. And I am forever grateful to all of those frontline providers.
Are there any cases in which family members can remain at the hospital to keep tabs at this point?
So this is a complicated question. So we still are caring for non-COVID patients at the hospital. And so we have sort of two tracks for patients and family members so that they can remain together as much as possible. For the non-COVID patients, we do allow one visitor to be there. Or I don't like to use the word visitor because families are not visitors in a loved one's life. However, we've been relegated to the place to make sure that we are creating models of care where we are serving public health more than we're serving individual health at this point, because we have to. We have relegated families to this visitor status that, unfortunately, it has come to that. In order to do this, though, we recognize that when people are critically ill, when people are at the end of life, when people are on hospice care, children, laboring women, there are a variety of situations where we recognize that it is in the best interest of everyone to have a family member be present. When it is a non-COVID patient, it's a little more flexible, although not entirely so. We still have to have some pretty strict restrictions in place. When they are COVID positive patients, however, we do need to make sure that we are creating that balance of still being human, still providing compassionate care, but yet making sure that we are keeping our staff and our public safe. So can people who have a loved one who's passing away with COVID at Beaumont have a family member present? First of all, we do our best to try to make sure that we have some virtual options to connect people. If that isn't going to work, if family really would like to be there at the bedside, we make sure that they understand the risks of being present. And once we feel that they do understand that, we do allow up to two people to be at the bedside of someone who is dying from COVID to be there to say their goodbyes at the end of life. This is the humane and the compassionate thing to do. We make sure that we do offer PPE to, not just offer, we do require PPE of these folks so that they do have to wear this, and our staff has to help them put it on and take it off to make sure they are doing it appropriately.
What are the hospital's obligations for the cases that are not end of life? What are the obligations to communicate with families about patient status?
For the last quarter of a century, there has been a push to recognize patients and families as core members of the healthcare team. No one knows a patient better than themselves or their loved one knows them. While professional staff might know the disease process and have skills to be able to provide certain types of care, people know themselves the best. So we have to maintain these opportunities for patients and families to participate in care planning and decision making. Even in these extreme circumstances where it is not in the best interest of anyone for them to actually be at the bedside. So we have a whole lot of ideas that we are putting into fruition. We're providing iPads to patients that are either non-COVID or COVID positive patients so that they would have an opportunity to be able to connect with their loved ones. The problem with this, though, is our COVID positive patients are so ill that even holding an iPad, even having that attention has been quite difficult. So we are establishing ways of attaching the iPad to a cart so that the person doesn't have to have the strength to even hold that so that they would be able to have these conversations. And our nurses and our nursing assistants have been critical in helping to connect our patients with their loved ones. We also are creating a whole host of ways that families can connect better with the nurses and with the doctors. Everyone is doing their best to keep families connected and having them part of decision-making. But with the harried pace that we are all under these days with this crazy, crazy pandemic that we are all living through, this has become a challenge. So we are looking, and we hope to implement this later this week, to create positions where staff that don't have as much work to do now because they might be staff that are involved with teaching physical therapy classes, or elective surgeries, we are redeploying that staff potentially to be able to connect with the families who are home so they are able to help them organize their thoughts and help understand what their fears and concerns are, and they can feed that information to the doctors and nurses so that when they actually do have that time to be able to speak on the phone or to speak through iPads, they have an organized conversation that they can get right to the heart of what the concerns of families are and what the questions of families are.
That's Kelly Parent with Beaumont Health. We're talking about how families can advocate for loved ones who they can't be with because of a COVID-19 diagnosis. More coming up after a break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking about the challenges that families are facing as loved ones hospitalized with the new coronavirus become isolated to contain the spread of the disease. My guest is Kelly Parent, Vice President of Family Experience for Beaumont Health. Beaumont is treating more than 1,000 COVID-19 patients across its Michigan facilities. As we heard before the break, most of these people cannot have family members with them. Let's get back to the conversation. You know, it's hard enough to be an advocate in a situation where we can stay at the bedside of the person we love. But this is so far from normal. If you had someone in your family who was testing positive for COVID, who was in the hospital, and you didn't know anyone, what would you do to be their advocate?
Well, that's a really tough question. I think that the most important thing is that we have to be creative. It's not always going to be up to that family member who might be across the country living in Montana and they have an elderly loved one here at Beaumont getting care. So we as Beaumont have a responsibility to offer options to that family member. It's hard for them to even know what they can and cannot do. So we need to say, we have this liaison for you to talk with so that we can make sure that we're connecting with you on a daily basis. We have this opportunity where you can connect with your loved one through an iPad loaner system. We are also looking at the idea of creating a peer support program online so that people who are going through this together can understand, can connect with each other, one family member to another, because they know what it's like to have a loved one going through the COVID crisis when they can't be at their bedside.
Is it realistic that at this stage of medical record keeping that people might be able to stay up to date online with charts and other information like that?
So that's actually another complicated question. So Beaumont, as well as many, many other hospitals across the country, have patient portals where people have an opportunity to get in and see information through the patient portal. There's also something called open notes where people will have the opportunity to read the notes so that you understand exactly what is the health situation of the patient. However, in order for a family member to be able to give proxy to their loved one, this is paperwork that has to be signed. And sometimes a person that is so sick is not at the point where they can choose to give proxy to another adult loved one. So we are imploring our patients, all of the communities, to take care of these pieces up front. We need to make sure that our patients and our family members are thinking ahead as to what would they want in an end-of-life situation. How can they hand proxy access to medical chart records to their loved ones if they are not capable of giving that proxy access at the height of an illness? So there's a whole lot that we need to do up front while we are still healthy to plan for the event that we do become sick.
We know that elderly people are a portion of who's afflicted with COVID right now, but what happens in the case of minors? Are parents necessarily going to be allowed access to the bedside?
Absolutely. The way we have written our guidelines for visitation for people who are COVID positive is that end of life, we do allow family members to be present as long as they understand the risks for them being present. We also allow for extreme circumstances where we're able to make our best judgment of a situation and allow people to be at the bedside. Two very specific examples of this are when a minor has COVID, absolutely a parent has to be at the bedside. And with a laboring woman who is COVID positive, the laboring woman also needs to have her birth partner there with her as well.
Other hospitals in Michigan may have differing policies on this, though.
Correct. Other hospitals in Michigan may have different policies on this. At Beaumont, we've made the determination that a parent and a birthing partner are very extreme situations where we feel that it is in the best interest of the patient to have this loved one present.
Is it hard to get access to the translators you need right now?
It actually is not, because we have a variety of different ways to bring translators in. We do have some in-person interpreters to be able to help people speak and understand what is going on with care planning and decision making. But we also have telephones where we can call interpreters from many, many, many different languages to be able to interpret on the site for these individuals. So it is not as hard as one might think.
Right. We want to thank you very much for everything that you're doing right now and for all the work that's happening on the front line. Kelly Parent is Vice President of Family Experience for Beaumont Health. Kelly, good talking to you.
Thank you very much, and be safe.
The COVID-19 pandemic has completely upended life for people all across the world. The massive changes to daily routine and all the uncertainty of the pandemic are stressful for everyone, but it's certainly changing mental health as well. Dr. Arash Javanbakht is director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University's Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Javanbakht, welcome to Stateside.
It's a pleasure.
We're also speaking with Allison Miller. She's a developmental psychologist and associate professor at the School of Public Health with the University of Michigan. Allison Miller, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I just want to ask how you both are doing. Allison, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, I'm a parent, so it's definitely changing my life in that way with kids being home and trying to get everything done from home. So on a personal note, certainly that's been a change. Also, you know, just the way that everybody has been coping with these massive changes has been impressive to me when I've been working with colleagues and the families that we see in our research studies. Everybody's kind of pulled together in a way that I think has been supportive interpersonally, even though we're physically distanced. But it's been hard.
Arash, how about you? What's your situation?
Well, actually, a couple of weeks before having to stay home, I came back from Paris, so I had to stay at home. So I have been sitting at home for longer, and maybe I had more time to cope with it. From a work perspective, well, I used to do telemedicine, and research a lot of times is flexible, so it has not been too much of coping. But on the other hand, I'm a very social person, and a lot of my life was social interactions, whether it was at the gym or interacting with friends at the coffee shop or hanging out, spending time together. That is cut out, and it has been a challenge to cope with that, and also trying to keep the routines of life, including staying active and healthy, has been a challenge that I've been working on and getting better.
No doubt. Allison, your work studies risk and resiliency in children and families. Short of, I guess, a wartime situation, can you imagine a more challenging time for the family dynamic than this?
Not really, no. It's really been the focus of a lot of the people I've been speaking with, colleagues, friends, just how to manage all of these new situations that we're finding ourselves in. Certainly with families who are lucky enough for the parents to be able to work at home, it's been a challenge just in terms of meeting everybody's needs, having everybody in the same space when they're used to being out and doing different activities in their lives. Certainly, kids of different ages present different challenges for family dynamics, and I've been talking about that as well with, again, friends and colleagues who have kids of different ages.
Arash, what's been most striking to you about stresses on patients coming to the clinic?
Well, there are multiple stressors that people are dealing with at this time. And actually, a lot of factors that contribute to stress and trauma and anxiety in general are in the what's happening to us right now. One is the transition. Transition is always stressful. And everybody is going through multiple transitions, from changes in the work style, having to be at home, spending time with the kids, not being able to do a lot of things they used to do. And this all happened very suddenly. We didn't have time to transition. It was not like, okay, now we're going to transition over a course of 2 months to working from home. So that was stressful. Besides, there's the factor of uncertainty, which is always adding to the stress and pressure of what we deal with, where here we have the ultimate example. We don't know who has it, who doesn't have it. We are not very clear about how this pathogen works and for how long are we going to be here and what is the outcome. And then there's the lack of control that we have over this situation, which is basically any time we are in a stressful situation that we have not much control over, we are even more stressed. And now the only control here we have is to sit at home. And among the patients, to go back to your questions, well, I see the same stress, especially people. I work with anxious people, anxious and traumatized people, and a person who is anxious always has a lower threshold of detecting something dangerous, or they may overshoot for what is scary. Ah. And so they're more stressed. They may be anticipating the danger a little bit more than the facts tell us. And at the same time, they have been going through all these transitions. A lot of them are financial restraints. A lot of them have to spend more time with family, which can be good, which can be stressful, or spending time with the kids, homeschooling, stress of the work transition, having to work in a different setting. Not only that, but also for a lot of people, because of these restrictions, the work duties have changed. So they have to learn new skills and new ways of dealing with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm also exposed to creative ways that they have found to deal with this stress. For instance, just one example that I learned myself was, if a patient told me, well, to stay active, we now have, my and my husband have a commute time, which means in the morning and late in the afternoon, the time that we were supposed to be commuting to work, we now go for a walk every day.
Nice. This moment is not just an individual feeling of anxiety. There's, as you say, the much bigger worldwide anxieties that is in some ways contagious itself. I have found myself wondering which is more contagious, the new coronavirus or the fear that has been sweeping over people, and sometimes even reshaping the behaviors of people who are lucky enough to be healthy right now. What do you say to people about keeping that under control? I don't know. Arash, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. And this is kind of a paradox. In some sense, when the danger and threat is not right next door and it's not right here, we underreact, which was what we saw in the basically international response to the pandemic and lack of preparedness, as if when it is happening in China or in Europe or in the future, and it's not immediate enough to us, we are not ready to emotionally react to it and be prepared. And lack of preparedness can be seen across the Western world. But when it is here, yes, and it can be more stressful, especially when people don't know the facts, don't know where to get the facts, or they are exposed to too much data, which they cannot parse out what they can trust and what they cannot. Do you get data on the social media from friends, from family, from relatives, all these like weird theories about the issue, and then it comes to the media.
Yeah,
I always say that American cable news are like disaster pornographers. Basically, there's always an emotional intensity to the story told. And kudos to NPR. I tell my patients, listen to BBC or NPR, because do you just get exposed to the facts?
I just need to say, we do encourage people, if they need to also turn off sometimes if their anxiety level is getting out of control. It can happen even with the most moderated tone.
Exactly. And I tell that. I tell people that limit your exposure to news. Just get what you want to know. You need to know. Don't get obsessed with it. At least give yourself several hours of break from the news, not to be exposed to it.
Yeah.
These are some ways of like reduce, know the facts from the real sources, from the reliable sources, but then don't get over obsessed over checking every half hour how many people got infected and how many people died.
Allison, what are you telling parents right now about anxiety?
Yeah, I would echo much of what Arash was saying in terms of keeping kind of on a news diet, know the facts, you get the facts from reputable sources and on a regular basis. Also just encouraging parents to be aware that they'll hear about something big, like school closing, for example, and then they can find out more information at that point. I think an important thing also for parents to realize is that how much our stress kind of can carry over to our kids and in our parenting. And so we know from a lot of research prior that when parents are stressed, risks to children go up because it's harder to parent in a sensitive and effective way. And so one of the things that I've been trying to talk with parents about is taking some time to manage your own responses to the pandemic. And that can be things like taking a walk outside while we still can do that, just taking a moment for yourself to kind of de-stress and give yourself a break. Also to be kind to yourself and sort of forgiving of parenting maybe goals that you have under normal circumstances that you might let sort of slide during these circumstances. So a classic example would be sort of phone use, especially with teens. Teens' phone use can certainly be something that parents really try to moderate. And right now it's getting harder to do that because that's a primary way of socially connecting for teens and really for all of us. So that might be an area where parents can struggle because normally you might set more rules around phone use, but right now it feels perhaps more difficult to do so.
Right.
Still important to do so and to try to do routines that allow for alternate activities, but just certain areas of parenting might be really hard to hold on to while we're all stressed and managing our own stress.
We're in a situation right now where there are so many people grieving the loss of loved ones and who maybe haven't been able to do so in the ways that their families traditionally would have marked such an event. What do you think it's going to mean to have so many people going through the process of grief at the same time, Allison?
Well, I think it is really important to realize that grief and loss have many stages and take time to cope with, and that the trauma that we're feeling as individuals as well as communities will unfortunately be long-lasting in all likelihood in terms of coping. And so I think that one thing that's really important is thinking about, again, being kind of kind to yourself and being able to acknowledge your feelings, but manage, try not to let them get the best of you in terms of, I'm not being very articulate here, but in terms of engaging with other positive things in life. I think that what we know about grief, loss, and trauma, and certainly Arash can speak to this as well, but it's important to reach out and connect with others and also to be able to process those feelings, but it might be overwhelming to do so at the time, especially when we don't have our resources that we usually have, like physical contact with a family member, being even able to see a family member in the hospital or hold funerals or memorial services in the way that we would typically do and in ways that are healing for trauma and grief and loss.
When we come back, we'll continue my conversation about mental health during distancing with Dr. Arash Javanbhakt and psychologist Allison Miller. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. As we all try to come to terms with the anxiety and fear of physical distancing, we're talking today with two mental health professionals, Dr. Arash Javanbhakt, Director of Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety, Director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State, and University of Michigan School of Public Health psychologist Allison Miller. Arash, healthcare workers are under extraordinary stress right now. I mean, they are the ones who may be there with people in their final minutes and hours. They're doing the best job they can, sometimes with limited supplies. What are the lasting impacts of that kind of trauma?
Actually, this morning we had a team meeting discussing about possibility of looking at how this is impacting the healthcare workers, because not only they are enduring all the stressors that we mentioned other people are going through, but also now they have to deal with extraordinary levels of expectations from them at work, some of them not even fully prepared for this. An ER doctor may be prepared for this, but other physicians or other staff or nurses who were working in other, let's say dermatology, other fields now are being called to help because there's not enough staffing. So there are multiple ways that they are stressed. One is fear of, like, in reality, the fear of what may happen to myself. And as a result and consequence, my family. There are a lot of doctors who are now staying in their garages or in their basements because they don't want to be, or nurses, they don't want to be interacting with their family and putting them at risk. And then another thing, which actually any first responder, including the healthcare workers, is important for them, is the sense of control that I can do something. My job is to help. And now they are kind of helpless because we don't have clear treatments. We don't know what are the best ways of helping these people. And when it comes to a lot of people who end up dying, that is also very painful. Every time a physician or a healthcare worker loses a patient, they are stressed. So I imagine they are under intense amount of stress, different ways of thinking and feeling about it, from guilt, from frustration, from feeling of desperation. And then consequently, I would expect symptoms of trauma coming out and depression, anxiety, which we have seen in other groups, including first responders and medical workers who have been involved in natural disasters in the past. There's also some data coming out of China that people are burned out and stressed.
What would you tell hospitals right now about mitigating some of the stress that healthcare workers are feeling?
Well, I would actually have some ideas about in general how to deal with the stress for everybody, which could be used by healthcare workers, but then on top of that would be what healthcare workers would do separately. I mean, one is that we did talk about exposure to news and reducing that exposure to the minimum required, but also keeping our routines as much as we can. in general, like we used to go to the bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, have like a good meal approaches, like routine of when we had every meal and not eating all day long because we are next to the pantry, trying to keep those routines or establishing them. I know it is difficult, but trying to have them. And the other part is staying physically active for everybody, I suggest that, because we know a lot about how regular exercise, especially regular cardio workout, not only is a way to vent, but also reduces vulnerability to anxiety, depression, boosts the immune system, and helps a lot. And it can also be a bonding way when we are stuck at home. When it comes to that, venting also and discussing and talking and to other people can be very helpful. I don't like the term physical distancing. I'm sorry, I don't like the term social distancing. I despise it.
Why?
I would love people call it physical distancing because we can, you and I are now having a social communication while we are physically distant. We can be physically distant and safe, but not be asocial. The idea of social distancing from other people, not being connected to others, is scary to us. We are social creatures. I can have like, we have million ways of connecting to other people without being in a physical space with them. There are people who are doing happy hours and brunches and exercise and workout, everything on these video chats and calling friends, like our phones, our smartphones, other than the ability to use Instagram, surprisingly have ability to call people and talk to them. So there are ways to stay connected. And when it comes to the healthcare workers specifically, they need the mental health right now. They need the mental health care available to them. Of course, everybody has talked about need for having like a reasonable hours of work. You cannot have someone as work for like, I don't know, 100 hours a week. But sometimes this is a crisis situation. They have to having the PPEs for them, having them feel safe and having them feel in control. All the news that is coming at them that, well, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, you may not have your PPEs to deal with this crisis. Well, these are very stressful to these people because they also worry about their own health and the health of their family.
Yeah. Allison Miller, one of the real conundrums of this is that normally in times of stress, some of the things that we do to feel better is to, you know, go into social places, meet up with our friends or spend time with our family. Arash talked about some of the physical things, you know, some vigorous physical exercise that might be an option. Is there anything that you are talking to folks about maybe if you're less active or if you've got physical limitations on what you can do, things that might be essential to sort of counteract some of the effects of social distancing right now? Excuse me, physical distancing right now.
Physical distancing, right. I agree with the use of the term physical distancing as well. There are many different social ways to engage that are virtual. I've certainly seen and participated in things like Zoom connections with friends and maybe treating this time as an opportunity to reach out and connect with friends or loved ones that you may not connect with on a daily basis in one's regular life. And so I think that type of social connection is very important, and perhaps even building it in on a regular basis into your daily routine might become an important thing to do. Another thing that I've thought about, it's not vigorous physical activity necessarily, but if we can go outside, if we can be in a little bit of nature, we also know that from research, looking at nature and experiencing nature can be calming to the biological stress system. And so any opportunity, especially as the weather gets nicer, just to go outside and take a slow walk, if that's possible, is a helpful thing to do. And again, building it into your routine so that you can think of it as a restorative activity. I guess the other thing is to, if one has the bandwidth, think about kind of longer term projects that you might want to engage in and books you've not read and that kind of thing, sort of taking stock of what might be other activities to engage in that are not necessarily social, but could connect you with parts of yourself that are less stressed than dealing with the news of the pandemic in the moment.
So in line with what Allison mentioned, There have been a lot of things that we always thought we wanted to do if we had the time. Well, now there is the time. And I suggest, well, there, some of them are chores, but it's important to have some hobbies or fun activities, especially kind of creative, productive ones, because for a lot of us, the level of productivity and the meaning we get from that is reduced. And one other activity, which is actually related to nature as well, it's the spring. And there's one activity that we can do, which is productive, which is creative, which is healthy, which includes physical distancing and has some physical activity to it, which is gardening. It's mm-hmm. a great time to start doing that yard work and the gardening projects.
Right. Absolutely. And related to gardening, there's certainly cooking, right? So learning new things that one can cook, and especially if there are sort of limited ingredients, it might be time to be creative or challenge yourself with regard to preparing meals every day. And the other thing that I think that is important to think about is engaging in some sort of reflective or mindfulness relaxation type practices that can be really soothing and calming, again, to our biological stress systems. And again, probably many of us have apps on our phone that maybe, you know, we haven't used, but we downloaded at some point. Now might be a time to engage with those apps, like a yoga app or a, you know, other mindful relaxation focused app.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Allison Miller. She's a developmental psychologist and associate professor with the School of Public Health at the U of M. And we're also speaking with Dr. Arash Javanbacht. He's director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State. Some communities are hit harder by this than others. Detroit has become the epicenter of the state's outbreak. Some of the data we've seen recently shows that 40% of the people who died from COVID-19 so far in Michigan were African-American people. What does that do to the mental health, not just of individuals, but of an entire community? Allison, do you have some thoughts?
Absolutely. I think that sometimes when these tragedies happen at a community level, it's very hard to reestablish trust in the bigger systems that might be perceived to have contributed to this community-level trauma. Neighborhoods that are being really hit hard right now in this pandemic, especially in Detroit, are often already kind of living at the margins or have families in them that are living at the margins that are already depending on lots of social services just to get by. So things like food, shelter, transportation, childcare, medical care, mental health care. A lot of these services are very important for these families, and often they're not accessed. And as we were talking about earlier, this has been such a rapid transition that not everybody has gotten hooked up with the services that might be helpful for managing this community level stress and trauma quite yet. So that's something I think we really need to think about and make sure that our services remain in place and that we have in some way outreach to families who really need them, who are being really hit hard by this pandemic at a community level.
Arash, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, the African American community is traditionally underserved by professional mental health for a myriad of reasons.
This is a community that had, it's not like everything was good until now and then this happened. No, it's just one another step added to the cumulative trauma and stress, whether it's financial, whether it's housing, whether it's other safety-related issues and healthcare-related issues, as well as physical health and physical illnesses, which can worsen the situation. The other aspect is that the African-American families are very integrated and they're very, very closely connected, and loss of one member of a group and a family is very painful and hurtful to them. In terms of availability of mental health services, I don't have data that would suggest, like, when you compare at the same level of socioeconomic situation, one group of people has less or more access. Well, I work at Wayne State University in Detroit, and majority of the patients I serve there are African-American patients. And what I can see, I cannot answer your question directly, but what I can see is the resilience in this population. I work with the poorest of the poor, and despite all the difficulties, whether it's trauma or financial or housing or relationship issues that they have been dealing with, they're so resilient and so responsive to care and treatment that is provided. I really enjoy working with this population.
Yeah. Can you both think ahead perhaps to the weeks from now, the months from now, and I guess we should say the years from now, as we recover from what's happening, what are some of the things that public health officials or maybe you'd like leaders to think about when it comes to dealing with the fallout of the mental health epidemic related to COVID?
Well, I think we can acknowledge we are going to have a lot of financial hardship going forward. And again, it's families who have been living at the margins already or who are maybe under-resourced who are hit the hardest. But I think everybody will be hit at some level. And what we know from just decades of research is that, you know, living in poverty is a real risk factor for child development. And what we also know is that early childhood experiences can be very formative for later life outcomes. And so one of the things that we really need to make sure we have in place is that social safety net. It's already a bit frayed, quite a bit frayed in many cases, but we need to make sure that we have supports in place for the many, many families who will need to be accessing them. The other thing to think about, certainly now as schools have just closed down for the year, is that children who are in school settings or other sort of child care settings are exposed to teachers and other caregivers who may be able to and often do pick up on things like child maltreatment that may be happening in the family. And so without children going out into these other environments or other contexts, we kind of lose a little bit of our ability to prevent some of these behaviors from happening. And so that's something also to think about from a child welfare perspective. How are we going to keep our eyes on our kids in our communities in a helpful way that can prevent any negative outcomes of the stressors that families may be facing in these hard times as we go forward?
Arash, what are your priorities when you think about trying to help everyone heal from this?
So we would need a slow transition back to normal life because of all the issues that we mentioned that were stressful for us to get to this stage. Then going back to full force to normal life is going to be stressful. There will continue to be fears of what if it comes back to us. People who were traumatized by it or they're affected or they lost someone to it will be scared of it. The kids, Allison noted, trauma-induced and stress during childhood may have long-lasting effects. Even adults who went through childhood stress and trauma may have different physical illnesses more than others and be prone to trauma and PTSD themselves when they are exposed to trauma. It's not like if we don't see them, they don't exist. If we don't look for them, they don't exist. No, we got to go look at them. People don't come volunteer and say that I'm traumatized and I have nightmares. We got to go. So we need data. We need to know how much people in different groups were impacted, how much healthcare workers were impacted, how much people with less or more economic resources were impacted, those who got the illness and recovered. Right now, we have data on, we have the current data says 250,000 Americans were impacted. I'm sure there's a lot more because we don't test everybody. How does that affect? So first we need the data to see what is the extent of the emotional damage to people, and then we need the resources to deal with those, because this is not a can that we can keep kicking down the road, because We have tons of data from research that shows if we don't deal with it now, later on in 20 years, we'll have to deal with more cardiovascular illness, more obesity, more mortality, morbidity, diabetes, metabolic syndromes, and anxiety, depression, substance use. So this is something that needs to be quickly the resources provided to people. And of course, I'm not in a position to talk about, well, it's important for people not to be financially stressed and get their jobs. So that those are like responsibilities of others to take care of, to reduce the stress that would lead to worsened mental health.
Dr. Arash Javanbakht is director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State's Department of Psychiatry. We've also been speaking with Allison Miller, associate professor with the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. I want to thank you both so much for the work you're doing right now and for your time today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Join us tomorrow and we'll talk about how the sports economy in Detroit is weathering the COVID storm. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.